turn to Luke chapter 6. Father, bless these words to our hearts. You're talking about a person who's been hurt, and then a long time after that, it comes back to them. That is not an uncommon circumstance. A lot of people are like that, and you hear about them. In verse 35, the Word of God says, "But love your enemies, do good and lend, hoping for nothing again, and your reward shall be great. And you shall be the children of the Highest, for He is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. Be ye therefore merciful, as your Father also is merciful. Judge not, and you shall not be judged. Condemn not, and you shall not be condemned. Forgive, and you shall be forgiven." This is how you deal with it. People get hurt all the time. Satan makes sure of it. Insensitive people may make sure of it. Life makes sure of it. People get hurt all the time. And some of the hurts are severe. Have you ever met somebody who's gone through some extremely harrowing circumstances and they're not bitter? And you wonder to yourself, wow, how can you not be bitter? Once in a while you hear about some mother whose kid is killed and she's pleading for the killer. Or maybe visits the killer in prison and develops a close relationship to the killer. And you look at this person and you think to yourself, how can they do that? And I understand, okay, the love of God, and we theologically we can explain it, but really on a human level, how can you do that? How do you not get that hurt? How do you avoid getting wounded to the place where it's paralyzing? And it's written right here that you love your enemies. You love your enemies. One of the key things when somebody does something to harm you is to be merciful. That is not for their sake. That is for your sake. That is not for their sake. I understand you want to restore people and that part is for their sake, yes. But in what we're talking about right here, in this application, that is not for their sake. The person who benefits most from someone being merciful is the merciful person. Blessed are they merciful. Why? They shall obtain mercy. That is a very profound statement in context of what we're talking about. When something happens to me, I need the mercy of God. I need the love of God, yes, but more specifically than just generally the love of God, I need the mercy of God for myself. Before I can give it to you, I need it for myself. And so I need the mercy of God, not so that you can be restored, but so that I can continue. What you have is a situation that happens very commonly. People wound each other. Let's say you get into a classic old-fashioned spiritual conflict, angelic warfare. You have a church, you have certain people who are affected, they don't even realize it, by the prince of the power of the air, and they start cooperating with Satan's kingdom. They even take on Satan's ministry of accusation in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 10. And these people can do damage. How do I prevent them from doing damage to me? Because that's really all I can control. I can't make your decisions. I can control only what I'm thinking, what I'm experiencing through what I'm thinking. But I cannot control anybody else. I can try to protect, pastors try to protect the flock. Maybe if I'm somebody who's in a position to do so, I might try to protect the people I'm close to, friends, what have you. But ultimately, everybody's going to make their own choices. That's why you can't blame another person for your choices. They're your choices. They belong to you. They don't belong to anyone else. It's very easy to blame somebody, but God's not going to have any of it. Because God says, I gave you the volition, and when I brought a test in, these are the choices that you made. So we can't even go so far as to blame somebody, even if we feel justified in that blame. There are choices. And anything else isn't going to wash with God. And so let's say that you have a situation where somebody wounds you. Something happens and it wounds you. There's a lot of people who enter into that and they're stuck there. Then a deep root of bitterness comes in. And they don't even realize that that root of bitterness is there because of the time separation. And on a superficial level, they've learned to let it go mentally. In other words, they're not obsessing about it anymore. But that doesn't change what took place in the unconscious mind. And there's a deep root of bitterness that comes in. And something happens, and one day that root pops out. And it's starting to influence them, and it's influencing them badly. There was a solution to that, but the person did not apply the solution when the problem came. Instead, the temptation is, when something takes place that hurts us, is to look at it. Why? Because we're hurt. And we feel somehow that if we pay attention to the hurt, that will in some way heal the hurt. And secular psychologists may even tell you that. I say, well, you're in denial if you're not paying attention to the hurt. Well, maybe and maybe not. It really depends on what you're doing. If you're simply pretending, oh, I never got hurt, then probably you are in denial. However, you don't have to keep paying attention to the hurt either, and it doesn't mean that you're in denial if you don't pay attention to it. What you could be doing is applying mercy. You could go through this mental exercise, and it's a legitimate, important mental exercise, where you say, yes, what happened to me was wrong. Yes, I was hurt by this. Can I blame the person? No. Why not? They did it. Still can't blame them. Why? Because in 2 Corinthians 5:18, all things are from God. All things are from God. Who did the wounding? God did the wounding. For what purpose? I'm convinced that some of the things that take place in our lives that we don't necessarily understand, or that maybe they were wrong and never get corrected. And there's plenty of things like that. Things that never get resolved. Problems that never get settled. I'm convinced that some of these things take place not because of what God knows about us now, but because of what God knows about us in eternity. We don't know eternity. That's something we have to understand. We don't know eternity. We know we're heading there. We know something that the Bible tells us about it. But really, it tells us very little about eternity. It gives us eternal viewpoint. It gives us eternal words of God. But as to what the actual eternity is like, we know very little. We don't know anything at all about our lives in eternity, except that we will have lives in eternity, but we don't know the detail of those lives. I was thinking the other day, I'm looking forward to my horse in heaven. We're going to have white horses that we come back on when Christ returns. I'm looking forward to that horse. I don't know why. I just think it'll be so awesome to have a white horse like that, or any horse like that. I don't care what the color is, just to have a horse that can apparently go through the air. That will be amazing. And I'm looking forward to my horse. But that's just one detail. There's a whole plan, and it's part of the plan for our lives that God knows. And we see this in Revelation 2 and 3, that there's these certain things, like the white stone with our name on it. There's these things that are pertinent to our lives in eternity. But we don't have any idea, not even what our name is yet. But we know it's coming. Well, imagine in eternity, once we've been there for however you measure moments in eternity, actually probably they'll feel very much like they do here. Let's say that we're there for a heavenly 10 million years, whatever that means in heaven, in eternity. many moments. What are we going to be doing? We're not going to be bored and we're not going to be idle. What are we going to be doing? What is God going to be up to that He has us involved in it? We can go anywhere we like with that in our imagination. We simply know very little about eternity from the Word of God. We simply know that something will be happening. I think what God knows about us in eternity also is a part of what's happening to us now. For example, they that suffer with Christ shall reign with Him. Well, suffering with Christ may not necessarily bring me any tangible benefits right now. But in eternity, they're going to bring great honor. Suffering with Christ will be highly rewarded. It has great value. I may never see the value of it in time, but I will see the value of it in eternity. Now, why do I suffer in certain ways? I don't know. For example, why was Pastor Stevens so viciously attacked all over the world? People lying about him, literally lying about him, inventing stories when he could prove otherwise. And yet they lied about him on national television, in newspapers across the world, and he could literally prove otherwise. And yet they lied anyway. That's deep suffering. That's persecution. Why? Well, they that suffer with Christ will reign with Christ. Okay, fine, but why that type of suffering? Why did Richard Wurmbrand land in a communist prison being tortured for 14 years? Well, they that suffer with Christ will reign with Christ. Yeah, but why that type of suffering? Why wasn't he the one in newspapers and Pastor Stevens didn't go through some other form? Why? What did God know about those two men in eternity that wouldn't take place till eternity and maybe not even far into eternity that required suffering right now? We need to look at things from that perspective. We need to look at things from the perspective of God has allowed this, possibly even brought it by design, certainly allowed it by design. Nothing happens outside of design. God has allowed this, and I may never know why here in time. But I don't need to know why. What I need to know is that God has allowed this. All things are from God. There's another part of that I do know. All things are for my sake. Don't expect to understand how they are for your sake now. They are for your sake. There is a little bit of that we can understand. It's in Romans chapter 8. Let's turn there just for a moment. Start with verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and to them that are called according to His purpose. Whose purpose? His purpose. That is very important. His purpose. Not our own purpose. His purpose. That tells me that everything that takes place that is working together for good has an eternal purpose. For whom He did foreknow, He also did predestinate. For what? To be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom He did predestinate, He called. Whom He called, He also justified. And whom He justified, He also glorified. This shows me that everything that is taking place has an eternal purpose, and I can't understand the eternal purpose because I'm not in eternity yet. I'm in time. Don't expect to understand what God is doing now when He is doing something with eternal purpose. He may give us glimmers of it, but He's not going to give us a full explanation of that which is eternal. Once in a while we may find some glimmer of it. Okay, I went through this and I ended up there and such got saved. And if this hadn't happened, that person wouldn't got saved. Okay, that's encouraging. That's great. It is encouraging and we should be encouraged by it, but that's not the full story. we can say, okay, maybe I wouldn't be able to minister to cancer patients with the ability that I had if I never had cancer, for the people who have had cancer. And maybe that is true. And that is certainly one part of the story. It's not the full story. We don't know the full story. And we're not going to know the full story. And I'll tell you what, I don't think we're even going to know the full story after the Bema Seat. We'll get our full reward after the Bema Seat. We may not know the full story. What is God preparing us for in eternity? Well, for reigning, what does that even mean? Reigning over what? Over Chicago? Over the United States? Over Liechtenstein? Here's the thing, we don't know. And because we don't know, we can't try to figure out what's really going on here. That's why we're really staring at the wound, is we're trying to figure out what's going on and how do I make it better. You're not going to. You don't have the ability, nor is it God's plan for you to do so. God's plan in that situation is Luke 6:36. Mercy, mercy. Mercy protects me. Mercy protects my capacity. Mercy protects my ability to live with God. Mercy protects my decisions. The worst thing a person can do is make decisions out of wounds. Mercy. Mercy. But they wrong me. Mercy. Mercy. That's God's provision. Mercy. Now, once I receive this provision of mercy, then it says, judge not. Don't judge. In other words, don't evaluate what's going on by your natural understanding. Not the people, not the circumstances. If all things are from God and I judge the circumstances, what am I doing regarding to God? Judge not. Don't judge it. Don't make any determination about it. Just leave it alone. Don't judge the people involved. But they were wrong. Doesn't matter. Leave them alone. They belong to God. Leave them alone. They don't belong to you. God doesn't want you touching them. They belong to God. If you're tempted to touch them, think about Uzzah and the ark. Now, let's go back to Luke 6 and verse 37. Condemn not, and you shall not be condemned. How does that work? Well, it works on a few different levels. One of those levels is that if I can't appropriate mercy to another, it's because I can't appropriate mercy for myself. If I can't appropriate grace for another, it's because I can't really appropriate grace for myself. But there's a deeper level than that also. Romans chapter 2 and verse 1. Thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judges, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself. So if I'm over there judging and condemning, I've condemned myself. Why? Because it continues, for thou that judgest does the same things, plural. And so, that combined with Matthew 7, 1 and 2, whatever I'm condemning you of, I may say, this person is dead wrong, I may judge you and condemn you, and I say, this person is dead wrong, and they deserve it, and they're horrible, and all this, and God is saying, okay, now it's on you. Your fact became your downfall. Why? Failure to practice mercy. Your fact became your downfall. And so, back in Romans 6:37, it continues, forgive and you shall be forgiven. When Satan attacks and he causes wounds like that, he wants us very much to turn on the other person in judgment. Now, does that mean that I deny that something happened? No, it does not. Does that mean that I deny that I'm wounded? No, it does not. Does that mean that I deny that it's very painful or difficult? No, it does not. I just learn what to do with it in the circumstance of being wounded or having it be difficult or what have you. The response is more important than the problem. What Satan wants is to create a problem and then control the response. So what he'll do is he'll get something like a person attacking another person and that person gets wounded, and then he projects to the wounded one, they're all these things. Could be they are, but they belong to God. Is it wrong of me to recognize that they're wicked? No. It's not wrong to have their recognition. It is wrong to assign something to them. In other words, I can't make a statement about the person in their essence. I can understand what they're doing is wicked. But the person themselves, I can't touch them. So I can say, the attack was wicked. The attack was evil. But the person themselves, I cannot assign, you're wicked, to that person. Because then I'm judging the person rather than recognizing what's going on. But Satan wants to project that to us, so now he initiates a circumstance and then he initiates the response. And both people are equally in trouble at this point. We want to avoid that. What's the solution? Mercy. Mercy is the solution. It was wrong, but I love my enemy. Now when I say that, I don't mean I'm going to be affectionate toward my enemy. But then that's not what it means. What it means is I will be patient toward my enemy and I will be kind toward my enemy. In other words, I won't give them what they deserve and I will give them what they don't deserve. But I won't dwell on it. I'll control my thinking, and though I may be wounded and I'll take my wounds to God, I won't live in it. And then this next part is crucial. Forgive and you shall be forgiven. That's the ultimate manifestation of mercy. Forgive and you shall be forgiven. That word forgive, if you look it up in the original language, it is talking about releasing someone from prison. We get into these situations and we don't forgive and we end up prisoners to what those people did. And maybe they got right with God. But we're still in prison. The second half of Matthew 18 is all about that. We don't want to end up in prison to what other people did. That's where that root of bitterness comes in. When that root of bitterness enters into a person's heart, that's the prison gate. And they live in wounds, and they live in anger, and they live in frustration, sometimes in humiliation, and they live in all these negative effects that perhaps the activity of a certain individual triggered, but God allowed. And these effects, because they were handled outside of mercy, take me into a root of bitterness, and that root of bitterness becomes my prison. And it pops up, and I don't have to live in it all the time. But if something, let's say the person's name gets mentioned, all the angst and all the wounds and all the anger and all the stuff that's associated with this comes back again. And I can never seem to get victory, and it'll start plaguing me more and more. Forgive. Need to forgive. Forgiveness is not for the sake of the offender. Forgiveness is first for the sake of the offended. Forgiveness is not for the perpetrator first, it's for the victim first. We protect our hearts with forgiveness. Forgiveness is the application of mercy. And so I apply mercy and I forgive my enemies. Does that mean I become buddies with them? No. I just let it go. I don't hold it against them. You can't get victory without forgiveness. So we forgive that person, we release them from the bondage of what they did. In other words, we stop holding it against them and we are released from the effects of what they did. It releases us from anger, releases us from wounds, from pain, sometimes from humiliation, frustration. Whatever the results are, it releases us from those. The best thing a Christian can learn how to do is instantly forgive. Don't wait for people to apologize to you. If you wait for people to apologize to you, I will guarantee you, you will develop roots of bitterness. Because some people will never apologize to you. But you know what? You don't need them to. It's okay to just let it go. How many people apologize to Christ for adding sin to His body? We don't actually do that. At the same time, He still doesn't mark iniquities. At the same time, He still forgives all our sins. At the same time, He still cleanses us with His blood. You don't need someone to come and make it right in order to forgive them. You forgive them for your own sake, because God is merciful and He'll give you the mercy to do it. You forgive them for your own sake. People say, well, I'm too angry to forgive. You know, you can still be angry at the person if you insist. It's not going to do much for you. But you'll find that you'll feel a whole lot better about the situation that took place if you do forgive them. If you're worried about how you feel about it. And it's okay, you're human. But your mental health, your emotional health, and certainly your spiritual well-being depends on that forgiveness taking place. Well, I need some kind of restitution. Well, then you rejected the mercy of God. Your restitution was Christ. Christ took what they did, put it on His own body, washed Himself in the blood, and took it to the grave. There's your restitution. That's all the restitution God offers. Notice when David killed Uriah to commit adultery with Bathsheba, when Nathan the prophet challenged him, David said, "Against God I sinned," and Nathan said, "God has forgiven you." He killed a man to have his wife. How did he sin against God? But the fact is, that's exactly what he did. He sinned against God, and it was God who forgave him. Because David was God's, and so was Uriah, and so was Bathsheba. Forgiveness was the only option there. With us, forgiveness is the only option. Now, if I reject forgiveness, then I have to understand what it is that I'm rejecting. I'm rejecting all that Christ did. I'm rejecting the work of the blood. I'm rejecting what took place at the cross. I'm rejecting the finished work, and I'm rejecting God's purpose. That's why we end up in jail and God makes sure of it. Unforgiveness is a worse mistake than whatever the offense was that may have taken place. Not that it's a worse mistake for me only. Yes, it's a much worse mistake for me, but not that it's just a mistake for me only. It's a mistake against God, because it does violate things like the blood and the cross and the finished work. That's why God takes it so seriously when He says, if you don't release people from their mistake, I will make sure you go into prison to their mistake. And then God releases those people. It's Romans 14:4. Forgiveness is vital. It's not just that it's a command. It's like God doesn't have to command you to breathe. You just need to. You forgive the way you breathe. We need to learn to. Because if we don't, then we get these bondage-inducing roots of bitterness. And those roots of bitterness can destroy us. They can cause us to make all kinds of weird decisions, bad decisions, and they can plague us for the rest of our lives. And you know, that's exactly the victory that Satan is looking for. So when something happens and Satan brings something, don't give him any victory, including your ability to forgive someone. Don't give him any victory, and never make a decision on the basis of that. Now, you may need healing, and that may be legitimate. You may not be able to hang around that person for a while, and even that may, to a measure, be legitimate, depending on your capacity. But you don't have to go into bondage. Now, when I say forgive or have mercy, I'm not saying be buddies. I'm just saying apply mercy. When we read love your enemies in verse 35 of Luke 6, it's not saying love what they did, and it's not even saying like them. It's saying be patient toward them and be kind toward them, because it protects you. That's what we really need to understand about forgiveness. Forgiveness is for our own sake before it's for the sake of the offender, and sometimes it will never be for the sake of the offender, but it is always for our own sake. Amen?